Hey folks, quick reminder if you haven't done so already, the Paychex Imbalances first ever audience survey is out there. You can complete that by going to paycheximbalances.com/survey. It's your chance to have your voice be heard. We're planning for 2017 and want to make sure that we have you in mind. So again, paycheximbalances.com/survey. Complete it today. Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to the Paychex Imbalances podcast, where we chop it up about working money for millennials with the hope we don't leave you saying one star.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychex Imbalances, all words.
And if you've been enjoying the show, drop by and hit us with the 5 stars on iTunes. If you don't know how, visit paycheximbalances.com/review. It helps us stay visible in the rankings, which means we reach more people.
If we reach more people, we help more people.
Indeed.
So today we're joined by J.D. Roth. J.D. is an accidental personal finance expert, founded Get Rich Slowly, wrote Your Money, The Missing Manual, created the year-long Get Rich Slowly course, and contributed the monthly Your Money column to Entrepreneur Magazine. J.D. was also kind enough to waste 1 hour of his life listening to me ramble through my thoughts and questions about personal finance and life in general at FinCon 16. And he's obviously a kind and patient man for this. Thanks for joining us, JD.
Thanks for having me. Hey, it wasn't a waste of time. That was awesome. That was fun.
I'm actually mad I couldn't have stayed there for it because I had to leave the day before to go out to a wedding. So he told me about the magicalness of it. So
the magicalness. I like it. Yeah, it was magical.
It's all about priorities there, Rich, man. You know, you make your choices. You make your bed, you know.
Happy wife, happy life.
So it's funny because I actually did make this same mistake. So I went to your website. We like do a little bit of research on the guests. And I Googled you first and I was like, man, the host of Funhouse, the voice of Johnny Quest, the producer of The Biggest Loser. I'm like, when did he find all the time? I went to your website and it says, no, that's a different J.D. Roth trying to ride on the coattails of my success. So have you met this other J.D. Roth TV producer? Like, are y'all just kind of passing in the night?
But I want to, you know, so he produced Biggest Loser and the other J.D. Roth. And I've struggled with weight all my adult life. And so in 2009, right in the thick of when I was writing Get Rich Slowly, I was also in the process of losing about 50 pounds or wanting to get inspired to do that. I didn't actually lose it till 2011, I think. And so I was watching The Biggest Loser and I was like, oh my gosh, this is produced by J.D. Roth. And I had known about this guy because people always used to tease me when I was in college. Oh, are you the guy who produces Funhouse? And and so I tried to contact his production company. He wouldn't have any – I never heard back. But I keep trying to get in touch with him. He released a book. It's actually a very good book on fitness earlier this year. And he was like doing interviews. And if I was traveling in an RV at the time around the country, otherwise I would have tried to get a hold of him and see if I could have done an interview. I think I might have been able to do the J.D. Roth interviews, J.D. Roth interview. It would have been fun.
Yeah, you might need to do I was going to say you might need to do one of those reality shows or like get Oprah involved where they help you reconnect with someone that you've been trying to connect with.
Right.
I was going to say, I hope this podcast could be the stepping stone that you need, that someone's listening, that in passing, JD's listening here. He's like, you know what? I'm going to make that happen. So I'm going to put that into the universe, that positive secret. The only claim that I have for some reason is that, so there's just a bunch of bad Marcuses in movies. So Boomerang, so people have been harassing me about being Marcus from Boomerang, Marcus to be exact. And like, it seems there should be a string of characters that have bad personality types also named Marcus. That's like about the only thing that I relate to.
Huh. I've never known another Marcus. So all I have is a positive impression because of you.
First time for everything. I hope so.
Don't watch any movies then going forward. So tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you got started here. I got a couple prompts, but is there anything that we didn't hit on here that just kind of folks need to know about you?
Well, you mentioned that I call myself an accidental personal finance expert, and I think that's very important for people to know. I don't have any kind of formal training. I'm not a certified financial planner. I don't have any kind of financial degree. I went to school. I went to college, graduated in 1991 with a psychology degree, and an English minor and a buttload of debt. But it wasn't student loan debt. It was a credit card debt. I managed to get through college without student loan debt, which is a miracle. But I had the beginnings of a credit card habit, and that just developed through the 1990s until it was around 2004. I figured out I had over $35,000 in consumer debt, and I was feeling swamped. I was no good with money is what it amounts to. And some friends recognized that I'd kind of hit rock bottom with my money, and they recommended I read a couple of books. One of them was Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. Mm-hmm. And the other was Your Money or Your Life by Joe Dominguez and Vicky Robin. And I took the information that I gleaned from those books, and I used it to start a website called GetRichSlowly.org. Built that website over the course of about 3 years. Sold the website in 2009, but then stuck around for another 3 years as the primary writer and editor before I decided, oh, I'm done. I don't want to write about money anymore. Yeah. I'm bored of this. And yeah. So I thought I would retire. So I gave that up for about 3 years. And then last year, 2015, I realized, you know, I'm not done writing about money. I really enjoy it. So I came back and started Money Boss.
This kind of sounds like the rapper Mace, how he left the game and then and then came back a few years later. Like, well, I guess it was a little different for him. He like went off and became a pastor and then went back to like rapping, which is an interesting transition.
Huh. I feel like there was another analogous example that you could have used there, but we'll go with Mace. So yeah,
I don't know why that was on top of mind. There was something about I left the game and then the game called me back, and that's kind of what I imagine happening here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, to be fair, man, I don't have a better example. Mace was an interesting go-to, but I'm gonna let you rock with it because I don't have something else to go to. So, JD, you did mention there that you got through college without any school loans. Is there any tips that you did? Did you work through school? Did you have a scholarship? Yeah. Like, how did that work out?
It was all that. So I grew up relatively poor. Not poor as compared to like, say, the people in Ecuador. I just got back from Ecuador, and so I got to see some of the poverty. Not poor in that regard, but poor for the United States, poor for my neck of the woods. I grew up here in Portland, Oregon. And so I knew my parents weren't going to be able to pay for me to go to college. It was all on me. And I didn't know how I was going to be able to do that. I wouldn't be able to afford it. I wasn't saving any money. So I realized, oh, I'm smart enough. I wasn't the smartest kid in school, but I was smart enough. And I had a lot of activities. So I just pushed that. And I'm a good writer. So when I did my college applications, I wrote very good essays and talked about how involved I like to be in the school. And schools like that. They want students who are going to be involved. And plus I did very well on the SATs. And so that combination of stuff allowed me to get scholarships for most of my college career. And then for all the money I needed for housing and living expenses, I worked three jobs through college. It was a little crazy.
I remember those youthful energy days. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how I did.
Yeah. So you actually had to write essays like on paper, which I'm pretty sure the generation nowadays does not have to. I was having a conversation about this a couple of days ago where like now everything is done on the computer, but like this was like when you really had to write everything. There wasn't really like, you know, type it out on the computer with the black background with the green font. It was like writing on like loose leaf paper.
Yeah, absolutely. Some millennial right now, like paper. What the hell are they talking about? Googling it somewhere. So another thing you had mentioned there is you said that you were kind of bad with money. And I've kind of, my thought has changed on this over the years because I'm not particularly good with money either. People are like, oh man, you wrote this book and you know, you must be this, you must be that. And I'm like, now I kind of feel like, and I read an article about this in a few cents, that there's just really personality types. So you're spender or saver. Do you really think it's that clean cut, or can someone learn or change, or do you not even buy into that?
Well, I think people tend to spend or they tend to save, but it's very rare that somebody is 100% a spender or 100% a saver, at least in my opinion. It's kind of like a continuum, I guess. On one end, you got the spender, and one end, you got the saver. And it's like this continuum, and in between, there's just different levels. And so for me, I was mostly a spender. But I think I talk about how people have financial blueprints. Basically, as you grow up, you get these mental blueprints about how to relate to money. And you get these blueprints from the messages, well, from watching what your parents do, I guess, from messages you receive on TV, from watching how your friends handle money, and from the books you read. And so you end up with this blueprint on how what money is for and how to handle it. And some of the blueprints are more effective than others. And you asked, is it possible to change? And I think absolutely it is possible to change. You're given that starting blueprint, or you develop that starting blueprint, but you can rearrange it and add things or remove things. And I've certainly done that in my own life.
I like that. I haven't heard that put that way before. And you mentioned something I pulled from the website. So jdroth.com, folks, and I have that in the show notes. But one of the quotes that I really liked, I like them all, and I pulled this especially quote from, was, I've been reading and writing about money for nearly a decade, and I find these I've been reading and writing about happiness for nearly as long. These subjects are deeply intertwined. So can you explain that a little bit, or why you feel that happiness and money are intertwined?
So, yeah. So a lot of people think that money can't buy happiness. And that's not actually true. It doesn't always buy happiness, but in a lot of ways it does. So studies have shown that wealthier countries tend to be happier. So the United States is a very wealthy country, and the people in the United States tend to be happier than, say, going back to my recent trip to Ecuador, they tend to be happier than people in Ecuador. It's not 100% true. You got this overlap going on, but it's generally true. And wealthier people tend to be happier than poorer people. Again, not 100% true. There's a little bit of overlap, but generally true. Now, the interesting thing is that money doesn't buy happiness in a linear way. If you're starting out and you're very poor, then the more money you get can buy you happiness more quickly. It helps you get the necessities in life, and then maybe a few luxuries. But once you reach a certain level, and there are studies out there that say what this level is, I can't remember. I think it's like $70,000 a year or something like that.
Yeah.
Once you reach this certain level, then each dollar you throw at trying to buy happiness actually has a very marginal return. So there is a relationship there. What I find is that people want to be rich, or they want to have money, because they think it's going to solve their problems, and that it's just going to magically buy happiness. And that's not really how it works. And what they're really after is the happiness in the first place, the things that they think will make them happy. So what I encourage people to do is to get clear on what it is they want in life. What do they think is going to make them happy? Take some time to really get clear on what your mission is, what your purpose is. And that can sound like it's very spiritual or new agey or just kind of woo-woo. And I don't mean that in a mystical kind of way. I mean it in a very realistic kind of way. Figure out what it is that you want out of life so that you can pursue that, and I guess structure your life and your money around that purpose, and pursue it with everything you've got.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I would think with that 70, whatever that number is, I'd imagine some of that has to do with being able to cover all of the basic needs that you have. I kind of think of the whole Maslow's hierarchy thing where, where there's a certain amount you need to make to cover all of your basic needs, because when you don't have those things, that's when people get really stressed out. But then, of course, as you go above and beyond that, that's where the happiness starts to, I guess, it's like diminishing returns, because it's like, all right, you have all of your basic needs met, and now you think that since you have those things covered, there you start essentially coming up with other things you think that you need and you think that you want that are going to increase happiness, but it actually turns out to be a little bit of a myth. So do you get that sense as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the history of people who've stumbled on large, not jackpots, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, windfalls. So like look at lottery winners or professional athletes or people who've inherited a lot of wealth very suddenly. People who have sudden wealth really struggle with finding happiness and managing the money. There are all sorts of stories. I don't have any at my fingertips, but I've written about this many times in the past, where there's a lot of different people who say win the lottery. I think they come from very poor circumstances, and they think, oh my gosh, this is going to solve all my problems. I'm going to be so happy. And actually, it ends up making their life miserable. And you can find interviews with these people who are like, I wish I had never won the lottery. It just made things worse for me. And it's because we have this idea that money is going to solve all our problems. And you know, I've seen this in my own life and in the lives of some other business owners I know, where we managed to have some success. Like in my own instance, I sold the first website, Get Rich Slowly, and it gave me enough money that I could do whatever I wanted for a time. I don't know, kind of in my head, I guess, I thought all of my problems would magically be solved. And that's not how it works. I sold the site. I was still 50 pounds overweight, and I couldn't just like buy, I guess I could have gone and bought liposuction or something. But in order to be fit, I've actually got to do the work, and I've got to do what it takes to be fit. Right.
Right.
And money doesn't buy that. And money wouldn't buy, fixing my relationships. I didn't have good relationships with my wife, now my ex-wife, or with my friends. That was on me, and it had always been on me. And it wasn't until I got the money and realized, this isn't solving the thing, solving anything, that I realized it had always been on me to fix the problems. I should have started long ago.
Got it.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way, and I do want to talk about Get Rich Slowly next. But even for myself, I was working on a piece. Still trying to figure out when or if it's going to get published. But that being said, I was working with the editor, and so I pitched a bunch of ideas, and one of them was, and even now as I'm walking through this sentence, I'm almost hesitant to say it, but it was basically living paycheck to paycheck at $75,000. That was the one that she was interested in, because her audience was a group of members who make, you know, over $100,000. So she said, I really think this one would be good. And it was almost like this, I don't really struggle to write. Rich knows this. Like, I just churn stuff the thousand like 5 minutes, and then I kind of go back and just edit it down. So I can churn out like 1,000 words, 3,000 words, and then I just kind of polish it and refine it. But with this one, it was like I had the block that I ran into is, and we've talked about this on the show, is almost being apologetic for success, even though I wasn't particularly successful. I lived paycheck to paycheck at that time, but it's just so uncomfortable to talk about money. Even though I started out, and I've talked about on the show, at $19,000, so I earned and I worked hard and I, you know, moved and around the country and actually chased a profession and job to just make money. But then when you finally get there, it's like you don't want to talk about it. Like, you're almost ashamed of the success that you have or reached. Was that something in some regard that you felt as well, or was it a different type of a circumstance?
No, and that's an interesting point, because I think a lot of people feel that. I didn't feel ashamed for my success, because I knew that I had worked hard for it. Yeah, absolutely, there's an element of good fortune involved. Not going to argue with that. I was in the right place at the right time, but I also did the right things. So I know how much work I put into it. So I didn't feel ashamed for having the money, but I know a lot of people who do, and it can be very uncomfortable to talk about money and to talk about your choices. And sometimes when you talk about your lifestyle, or what I should say, when I talk about my lifestyle, I don't even realize that what I'm actually talking about is money. And I can give you an example is my girlfriend and I recently did a 15-month RV trip around the United States. Mm-hmm. When we got home at the end of June, it was like a real culture shock. It was we had lived for a while, for 15 months, with just this lifestyle where we got up in the morning, we decided what we wanted to do. Do we want to move from do we want to drive from Austin, Texas to San Antonio today, or do we want to just stay in Austin? You know, that kind of thing. And we just made it up as we went along. And then all of a sudden we're home in Portland, and everybody's on a schedule, there's structure, everybody seems to be in a hurry. And it was really disconcerting. And so I've mentioned now a couple times that I'm divorced, but I have a pretty good relationship with my ex-wife. And so she and I were taking a walk together, and I was telling Chris about this, how frustrated I was but with just being overwhelmed by life. And she didn't get angry, but she tried to put me in my place. She's like, you know, JD, you're really, really lucky. You don't understand how lucky you are. You have the money to be able to complain about how you aren't able to figure out what to do right now and how you feel overwhelmed. Not everybody has that luxury. And at the time I was a little cranky, but looking back, you know, she's right. because I have some money now set aside and I have some savings, I have the luxury to take some time to do what I want to do. And not everybody has that. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is there are just some assumptions that I make or forget that I'm making. And I think we all do that when we talk about money, and it's why it's so uncomfortable. No matter who you are, if you're Marcus earning $75,000 a year and you're talking about the things you're doing, if you've got friends who are earning $25,000 a year, they might feel uncomfortable listening to you talk about what your choices are and what you're able to do. And to you, you're not even aware that you're making them uncomfortable.
Well, so I have a follow-up question for that, and because you know, I've made this transition from the East Coast to the West Coast, and it's expensive in both places. So I'm in the Bay Area, which is not cheap by any means, but I'm in a better position financially. And sometimes, you know, I've had conversations where I'm talking about things, and then, you know, someone's kind of like, "Yeah, I can't really relate to that." And so this light bulb went off. And so I wanted to ask you, do you feel that you've had to kind of be more thoughtful in how you message things now in terms of what you put out there content-wise? Because the folks who may have resonated with the earlier part of the journey and who maybe haven't caught up or are maybe still facing the same challenges may see kind of what you're saying today and feel that, you know, oh, you're not relatable anymore because you've climbed to the top of the mountain. So do you feel like you've had to change the way that you approach conversations or the type of content that you put out there as it relates to money?
That is a fantastic question. That might be one of the best questions I've ever got. Yes and no. So you're absolutely right in the observation that when I was writing it, Get Rich Slowly, and I'm writing about getting out of $35,000 in debt and learning to change my financial blueprint so that it's healthy and produces savings and wealth instead of like it's focused on spending, that's much, much more relatable to people because that's what a vast majority of people are going through. And at Money Boss, I'm coming from a completely different perspective. I've now been managing my finances for almost 8 years, almost a decade, in a successful way. And I feel like I have some ideas on how other people can do the same thing. And so I want to convey this information. So I it's a very different approach. It's going from somebody who's struggling and other people can relate to that to somebody who has achieved financial success and is trying to tell other people that this is a maybe not the right way to do it, but one of the right ways. And so I think that the Get Rich Slowly approach is much more relatable. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, do I try to change how I message things? Maybe a little bit. But one thing that I've learned for myself and for other people too over the decades that I've been alive, I'm 47 now, is one of the worst things I can try to do, not just financially, but in all aspects of my life, is try to change who I am and what I think and how I act in order to try to please other people. That's something that I used to do all the time, and it just created a lot of headaches. And it's part of why I spent and got in debt, actually, is you know, I'm just trying to emulate other people and to please other people. And it took a little bit of therapy and a lot of deep thinking and a lot of self-exploration to get to where I am today. But I really believe that it's important for all of us to be completely honest and true about who we are. You don't want to be so honest that you're hurting other people, obviously. But when I'm writing at Money Boss, I don't try to like temper things. I don't try to hide that I have a lot of savings because for one, it would be not completely honest and forthcoming, I guess. And that might mean that my audience is smaller. Maybe I'm now less relatable than I used to be. But that's just how it's going to have to be. For me, it would, I think, create a lot of problems if I were trying to pretend or to temper my message.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like it's almost like being kind of a false prophet in some ways where you're acting like you're still part of, you know, a group or at a certain phase in the journey, but you're actually, you know, kind of at a different place. And yes, the audience may be smaller, but you know that you're reaching an audience that's kind of at that point. And it's something that I've struggled with myself. Just like, you know, there are people who've followed me for years or have followed us for years. There are folks who have progressed at different levels. And I'm always thinking about, I'm always thinking about people who are earlier on in the journey, but I also think about the people who've been following for a while and they've kind of seen some of the evolution, and I don't want them to get lost as I progress along. So I can definitely relate to that. Now you mentioned therapy. So when you say therapy, do you mean like actually going and talking to someone, or kind of your personal, you know, meditation as it relates to getting things in order?
I mean actually going and talking to someone. So I have a psychology degree, and in college I thought I was going to be a therapist, a counselor. And so you'd think I'd be somebody who is comfortable with the idea of going to therapy. And yet it's always just kind of made me uncomfortable. But when I got the divorce, my wife, she said, okay, we're not going to fight this. It's all going to be good. But I would really like you to go to therapy and see if you can figure out some of this stuff that's causing you stress. Because I have a tendency to be a very anxious guy, nervous guy. And so I said, okay, I'll do this for you. And so I saw a therapist for about a year. And it was very productive. I mean, it was very helpful. It wasn't any of this like, why do you hate your mother or any of that kind of stuff. It was like trying to figure out, JD, why are you anxious? What is it that makes you so nervous? And it actually helped me identify some of the issues I'd been struggling with. I'm not so good with time management, for example. Between the therapist and my doctor, they diagnosed me with having ADHD, which is something I had never considered. And understanding that, realizing that I struggle with this condition, it didn't give me, I didn't use this as an excuse, but once I realized that this is what's going on, then I was able to create coping mechanisms, like learning to use lists. I have all these lists on my desk right now. And learning that I ought to medicate occasionally on the days when I really need to get things done. If I take medication, it helps me stabilize. So yeah, the therapist was very productive for me.
Yeah, and I asked that because a lot of people, there's kind of this idea about therapy, and a lot of people are actually ashamed to go out and talk to someone. It may not have anything to do with money. A lot of times it's something, there's one thing that's deep within you that is the source of all of the things that may not be going well in your life. And I think that it's important that people understand that everyone can go to therapy, and that's an option that should be open to everyone. You know, whether you're doing well financially, whether your relationship is going well, sometimes you need to make that sacrifice, even if it feels embarrassing or it makes you feel like, you know, you're not succeeding. It's worth it to take that time to go and have conversations and go through that self-discovery process.
So, and one thing that a friend told me is, I was talking with him about how I was nervous to do this. And he was saying, JD, you have a psychology degree. You wanted to be a therapist. And he said, think of it this way. You pay a personal trainer sometimes, right? I said, yeah, sometimes I do. I use a personal trainer because I know that the personal trainer can help me achieve my fitness goals. He said, well, a therapist is like a personal trainer, but for your mind instead of your body. And when he told me that, I was like, huh, all right, that makes sense. Mm. And it kind of broke down the barriers that I had.
Awesome.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things, and Rich knows I like to do this, so thank y'all for allowing me to do my little Google search over here. But, I mean, for the folks, I think they hear us, especially I think the folks around our age, maybe a few years younger. So I'm 34. I think Rich is 33. You 33 now?
33 on the cusp of 34 in, well, March. I mean, I guess that's not really the cusp. It's starting to feel cuspy, though.
Hey man, I'm at the point where I'm just rounding up to 40. So, you know, it is what it is. But what I try to tell folks is being cognizant, I wish someone had shared this with me, of the evolution of my happiness and my expectations. And I say that because at 20, I was forecasting what I thought would make me happy at 30. Mm-hmm. But then when I get to 30 and I'm making at that time like three times the income plus just the maturity of change. And the quote that I was looking up is the man or woman, to be fair, who views the world at 50 the same as they did at 20 has wasted 30 years of their life. But I think it's easy to ignore that your expectations, even of yourself and the things that make you happy, are going to be different at the time that you get to that arc that you're forecasting in your mind. So when you get to the end of that rainbow, you're going to have a different expectation of how big or small that pot should be, or if you're even still interested in gold. And, right. And that was something that kind of blew my mind. I'm like, man, I just need this. And I hit about 90% of it. And Rich knows this. I talked about it on a few shows, even our previous show. And then I got there and I'm like, this doesn't really make me happy anymore. I was more content because, as you said, JD, partially informed by, well, that makes other people happy, so of course it'll make me happy too. And I just kind of took other people's list instead of devising a list of my own.
Yeah. And I think that's such a great point because, you know, I think it's Daniel Gilbert who writes about how it's very tough for us to predict what's going to make us happy, even a year in the future, let alone 5, 10, 20 years in the future. And so it's people sometimes try to make decisions about what they'll want a decade from now. And they make life choices based on what they think is going to make them happy. But you actually have no idea what will make you happy because you don't know what life is going to, what's going to happen to you in life and what opportunities are arise and what choices you're going to make. So this is another reason that I'm very, I believe strongly that it's very important for people to get clear on what their purpose is and what motivates them and to create a personal mission statement. I preach this constantly at conferences when I speak at conferences, or again, I just got back from Ecuador and at this retreat in Ecuador, I helped people devise a mission statement. I just really believe that this is an important thing that everyone can do to, instead of focusing on the future, focus on now and what brings value to your life now so that you can pursue that and use that to guide your decisions.
Mm. So this idea of a personal mission statement is something I've heard Marcus talk about and I've heard it in other places. So I actually haven't written one for myself. So could you give like a quick overview of how you go about it or how you advise folks to go about create? I mean, it sounds pretty straightforward, but I know everyone has their own formulas for how they go about creating these types of things.
Well, and I don't have, this is a great question too. And it's, I don't have a concrete answer for you. If you ask me in 2 months, I would, because I actually have an assignment. I'm doing a presentation in a couple of months where my goal is to send, I think it's like a 2-hour presentation, and the people who attend are supposed to go home with a mission statement, an actual written mission. So what I do now is I try to get people to think deeply about what their core values are. And from there, I want people to create their own mission statement, and I don't care how they do it. But I'm gonna for myself, try to develop some sort of process that I can then teach to other people. But the basics of it are find an exercise, and there are several that I share at Money Boss. Find an exercise that helps you hone in on what is important to you, what your values are. And these exercises usually take an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, at least the good exercises do. And then once you've gone through these exercises to come up with what is important to you, see what the common themes are, because there's usually approach it in 3 or 4 or 5 different ways. And then you look at the different lists that you create and say, okay, I see in this list, travel is important to me. Travel is important to me in this other list. And then you think about it and you're like, oh yeah, travel really is important to me. Mm-hmm. And then you're able to kind of create a mission statement from that. So I'm not going to go into the whole exercise, but very briefly, an example of the kind of exercise that I use is there's a series of 3 questions that you can ask people. And one of them is, the first question is, imagine that you have all the money, you have unlimited funds. You have all the money you'll ever need. What would you do if money weren't an object? So that's the first question. The second question is, imagine that you go to the doctor and the doctor shocks you with the news that you're going to die in a year. It's not going to be painful, but a year from now, you're just going to drop dead. Knowing that, what would you do in the time that you have left? Mm. And then the third question in this series is, now imagine you go to the doctor. And the second question does not assume unlimited funds. It's your current life. What would you do if you only had a year left? Mm-hmm. And the final question is, now imagine you go to the doctor and the doctor says, dude, you are going to be dead tomorrow in 24 hours.
Oof.
No, no escape. What would you regret not having done? What didn't you get to be or do? Who did you not get to connect with? What is it that you missed out on life? And so if you answer those three questions and you spend time thinking about them seriously, you can then look at the answers for the three different questions and see what is what kind of bubbles to the top as what's most important to you. And that series of questions is actually very, very effective. But there are all sorts of other exercises that you can find on the internet or in books that work through similar things.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen a couple of exercises, and we've recommended one on our newsletter, but I know a popular one out there is there's like essentially a list of words, and it's like pretty much like a values bank, and you circle or check off all the things that resonate with you. Then you break those into subgroups, and then you kind of arrive at these core values that kind of become the North Star for how you make decisions going forward. So we'll link to something like that again in the show notes. But yeah, appreciate the three questions. I actually was jotting that down over here, like, huh, I've never thought about that before. Slow beard stroke.
Slow beard. And so I've created a downloadable at MoneyBoss. It's just a one-page free PDF download, and you're welcome to like grab that. If you go to the, I think there's a Money Toolbox link on the site. If you go there, it should be there, and you can just offer that as a download too.
Okay, cool. Link to it. Cool. Yeah, we'll have to drop that in the notes.
Definitely. And it's funny. I mean, I think this is a great conversation, so I hope the listeners feel the same. Yeah. Obviously, I'm a little biased here, but I have like one comment and then kind of one question for you.
Sure.
And it's funny that you say that when you were saying that you were putting together the presentation, because, you know, now that I've got the book out there, like I'm, you know, writing about the, it's kind of weird. I mean, you put yourself in these positions, then I'm like perplexed that I'm in these positions. So people are like, tell me about the book. And I'm like, I don't have it memorized. I got to read it again too. So
exactly. But,
so people ask me for these insights. They're like, so what did you go through 10 years ago when you were getting out of there? I was like, man, I don't know. I need a frame of reference. So I kind of need my elevator pitch for myself. And to mm-hmm. Rich's point, it's crazy. Even as we're doing this show, we get a number of insights and partially what we do for a living as well, given the professions that we have. Yet we don't sit down and ask ourselves, what's my personal mission state? What's my personal vision state? And then like to Richard's point, when somebody asks you like, hey, man, what makes you happy? It's like my mind is blown. Like you could ask me, you know, what do I do for a living? What is my job? And what will I kind of see myself in 3 to 5 years? But then you ask me, hey, man, what makes you happy? And it's like,
stare off into the distance.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get back to you.
Well, it is kind of like, I went through, I'd say 40, 42 years of my life without having any clear conception of what made me happy. And when you don't have a mission statement or when you don't know what your purpose is, then you tend to just make, I guess, decisions that are reactive and that they're in the moment. And they may or may not make you happy. They might provide a little bit of a immediate burst of happiness, but not give you long-term well-being, if that makes sense. Like for me, I like to play video games. They're one of my weaknesses. And I know I enjoy playing video games and they make me happy in the moment, but they kind of leave me feeling hollow and empty long-term, that there's no sense of long-term well-being, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between happiness and well-being. And for myself, I don't have my mission statement memorized, but it's something along these lines. I want to be the best person I can be physically, mentally, in all ways. And I want to do that by learning as much as possible and seeing as much of the world as possible, and then sharing what I learn and see with other people. And it took me several years to develop that mission statement. And I've had it now for about 5 years. And I'm actually impressed with how well it holds up. It took me some time to develop it, like I said, but here I am after having it for 5 years, and it's still true. I really do want to be the best person I can possibly be, and I want to learn and see as much as possible and then share it with other people. This is what makes me happy. And I don't want to pretend like I always follow that mission statement, because I forget. I get wrapped up and I go play video games, and I'll come away after 3 hours of playing a video game and I'm like, oh yeah, that was fun. And, but if I do that for a week in a row, say I spend my afternoons playing video games for an entire week, then I start feeling bad because, I really am not doing anything that contributes to my long-term well-being. And I'm not feeling bad because I'm not pursuing my mission statement. It's not like I go, oh, I shouldn't have played video games because it's not aligned with my mission. But the reality is I kind of am wasting time, I guess, instead of, doing something that would make me happy. And if I would instead spend that time learning Spanish, or meeting with somebody like Marcus and sharing what I know, those things would make me happier because they're more aligned with who I am.
Got it.
Yeah, I like that alignment because that's something that we've talked about on the show, because we've gotten really big on the personal mission statements and vision statements as well. And then we had a guest on the show that talked about purpose and values, which I think is all intertwined. It's mm-hmm. right, like a cube or a, wow, I really just lost that, but where the circles overlap. The Venn diagram, I was like, am I going to have to live Google this?
I like the idea of a cube. I was wondering where that was going.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I definitely had one of those look up into the right moments. I was like, a cube?
Huh. It was not coming to me, man. I was like, come on, save it. So what experience do you hope people get from Money Boss that either differentiates from Get Rich Slowly, or do you just kind of see it as a continuation of your timeline?
No, for me, Get Rich Slowly was very much me in real time trying to figure out how money works. And I feel like it was, most of the material was written for people like me who I would consider beginners at personal finance. Now at Money Boss, for a few months, I was calling it advanced personal finance. And I guess in a way it is. But what it really is more challenging personal finance. Instead of saying, oh, you should just save 5 or 10% and get out of debt, I'm like, no, hell no. Set more ambitious goals. Save half your income. And maybe you can't save half your income now. I'm not saying that you can just leap from being in debt to saving half your income. But look at that and say, okay, this is my target. I want to save half. Save half is something that I push. And figure out how you can get there. So Money Boss for me is a way to try to push people to better pursue their purpose by aligning their financial lives with their values. And in general, that's going to mean learning how to build that margin between earning and spending to as high as possible.
Yeah, I think it's probably just math, but why do you pursue half? Like what is the goal of driving towards half?
Well, half is a convenient number. It's a convenient number. It's also very big, but it's not too big. A lot of people think that, oh my gosh, that's huge. But when I look back at my life, I've known many people where, or many couples where both members of the partnership work and they save one of the incomes. They live off one income and they save the other. So right there, you've got couples that are saving half. And I suspect that we all know couples like that. Mm-hmm. So it's obvious that it's not an impossibility. I also know people who save 30 or 40%. My ex-wife has always saved 30% of her income, whereas I was a deficit spender getting into debt. But yeah, you're right. It is just math. The reason I push the 50% is I think a lot of people think what they want is early retirement. And I think people do want early retirement because it allows them to
If you're like me, you probably hate grocery shopping. And if you're like me, you probably hate figuring out dinner every night. And that's where HelloFresh comes into play. So HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novice chefs like myself to seasoned home cooks. And one of the best things about this is if you're cooking just for yourself, each meal could last you 2 days. I discovered that when I was making this sizzling beef stir fry last week. I promise you, it really was sizzling. And if you're wondering how the food gets delivered, it arrives at your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. So for $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks. Again, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks when you subscribe. Check it out.
Shift from working for other people to pursuing things that are more meaningful to them, whatever those might be. So if you save, say, 10%, I don't have these numbers in front of me, so I'm going to be a little bit off on my math. If you save 10% of your income, yes, you're going to build savings, you're going to build wealth, but it's going to take you, I think it's something like 50 years. Yeah, I think it's 50 years. 50 years to earn enough to be able to retire. It's just how the math works out. So if you're starting at 20, it's going to take you till you're about 70. If you boost that savings rate to 20%, you reduce that time to, again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's like 37 years or something like that. But if you can get it to 50 years, I know that it's something like 17 years. Did I say 50 years or did I say 50%?
50 years.
Yeah.
My mind is going. I need more coffee. No, if you can.
I think the people follow.
I was sitting here like, damn, I guess I'll be 83.
If you can boost your saving rate to 50%, then it only takes 17 years to get to where you can retire. Or maybe retirement isn't your goal. Maybe you're wanting to quit your job and travel the world. Or maybe you're wanting to send your kids to college. Or maybe you're wanting to start a business. Whatever your goal is, the higher you can get your savings rate, the sooner you can pursue that goal, or the more effectively you can pursue that goal, whatever the goal is.
Yeah. And you mentioned starting a business, which is something that, you know, I think about, something that Marcus and I have talked about. And we have a lot of listeners who have side hustles or are interested in entrepreneurship down the road. And so that reminds me of what you did with Get Rich Slowly, where you got to the point that you could sell the site. And it's funny because I remember randomly years ago, like visiting the site, I didn't know you at the time. And I remember seeing the post about the transition. And, you know, I've run a couple of blogs and have had aspirations of, you know, having a big successful site that is eventually in a position to be sold. So is that something that you imagine could even happen with the site? And then from there, I guess, what advice would you have for people who are, you know, who are launching a blog or launching a website and are thinking about, you know, getting to that point where they're in a position to be able to sell it off?
So are you asking, is that something that I had envisioned for Get Rich Slowly?
Yeah.
No. So when I started Get Rich Slowly, I had three objectives. One was to help myself figure out money, because I didn't have any idea what I was doing. So it was a way for me to kind of process things. I'm the kind of person who processes things by writing about them. I read a bunch of stuff and then I kind of write down what I think I've learned. So that was my number one goal. Number two was to, as I'm doing that, to help other people or to teach other people what I'm learning. And the third goal, and this was just kind of an afterthought, was to make some money to help myself get out of debt. Because remember, when I started the site, I still had $35,000 in consumer debt. And I was very fortunate that along the way, because of my approach and because of a variety of things, I built an audience, and from that audience, I was able to make more money than I had anticipated. I paid off my debts. I was able to quit my day job and blog full time, and then I was able to sell the site. But even 2 months before I sold the site, I had no idea that I would ever sell the site.
Huh.
I sold it. The deal closed on April 1st of 2009, and that year it was January of 2009, I had made a resolution that, you know, people keep emailing me about buying the site. I thought it was ridiculous. Why would they want to buy the site? And I made a resolution. I said, all right, I'm going to respond to these emails instead of ignoring them. And the first guy, he said, I want to buy your site. And so I emailed him. I said, how much will you pay me? And he said, I'll give you $5,000. And I laughed because I was making more than $5,000 a month. Why would I want to pay or to sell the site for $5,000? And that's what I thought most of these emails were going to be like. But the second one, I emailed them and they said, we want to buy your site. I emailed and said, how much will you give me? And they said, well, we don't know. We can't just make a number off the top of our heads. You got to give us your financial documents. You got to disclose your Google stuff, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of freaked me out. But I gave them the information. And after talking to my lawyer and my accountant, and waited at several weeks for them to come back with a number, and they gave me a number, and I was like, holy cats, really? Yeah. People will pay this much for a website? And anyway, from there, it was a little bit more complicated. We get brought in another bidder and so on. I think the second part of your question is, what advice would I have for people who want to do this as a side hustle? And I think in my case, I'm not really, even though I have an entrepreneurial background, both for myself and from my father. My father was a serial entrepreneur. I don't recommend that people go into starting a blog with the idea that they're going to get rich doing it, or that they're going to make a lot of money. It's fine to do it as a side hustle, mm-hmm. but don't focus on the making money part of it. What I do at Money Boss, I only recently put ads on it after a year. I'm not focused on making money there. And when I talk at blogging conferences, I try to get people to not focus on the financial aspects. I want people to tell their story, be personal, be relatable, be vulnerable, and give advice. Create material that you would want to read, or that maybe your brother or sister would want to read. A lot of times at Get Rich Slowly, I thought, okay, if my brothers came here, would they find this article useful? And that's actually something I need to get back to at Money Boss. I'm proud of the material at Money Boss, but it's been a little bit less relatable, I think. And mm-hmm. it's because I'm not focusing on writing for this imaginary brother or an actual brother. So my advice to people who are trying to do this as a side hustle is pick a topic that you feel strongly about or you know a lot about. Write about that. Don't pick a topic just because you think it's going to make you rich. Write about it in an authentic way and create material that's going to be useful for people and that they're going to want to share with other people. And if you do that and you build an audience, then you're going to be able to monetize the website or the podcast or whatever it is. You're going to be able to make money from it if you build the audience and get people passionate about what you're producing.
Got it. And just one quick follow-up, and then I know we're moving into the tail end of the show here. You know, there's a lot of talk about traffic and numbers, and even with the podcast, I've said, you know, I want to get to X number, you know, downloads, or when I was blogging, we need to get to X number page views. Do you have any insight on what that threshold is? You know, is that a myth? Is there really a threshold for what, you know, makes sense for when people should start monetizing? You know, of course, there's things where people can create their own courses and digital products right away. But when you talk about, you know, ads and sponsorships for a website, have you found that there's been kind of a sweet spot or threshold, at least in the niche that you've been operating?
I don't know is the only real answer I have to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could give you some made up thing, but I don't have enough information. For me, obviously more is better. A bigger audience is better. But I don't know anything about the hard and fast rules. For me with Money Boss, again, I'm in a fortunate position where I don't have to produce income right away. But one of the reasons I didn't monetize from the start was, to me, ads are fundamentally reader hostile. And I know not everyone agrees. Some people believe that if you provide the proper advertising or the proper product that you're trying to sell, whether it's a course or whatever, then it's actually a benefit to the reader. And I get that perspective. But to me, in my experience on the web, I generally find that advertising or pitches to try to get me to spend my money, they detract from my experience rather than improve it. So at Money Boss, for the first year, I've been like, no, I'm just trying to build this readership. I don't need to implement the advertising just yet. I don't want to be reader hostile. I want to be reader friendly. And that's why I don't do pop-ups, for example. I hate pop-ups when I go to a site. And so I don't want to do anything at my site that I would hate if I were going to another site. Now, having said that, I have started implementing some advertising at Money Boss, and I'm talking with somebody who's going to help because I hate doing the ad stuff myself. I'm going to pay somebody to help me with that. So that was a long answer to say, I don't know.
No, well, it's helpful because a lot of people, they make that mistake, and you touched on this, that when they get started with their thing, whatever that thing is, they're thinking money first as opposed to the experience and as opposed to what they're passionate about. And I've made that mistake myself where I've known the topics that I should be talking about, but I felt like I needed to talk about other things because that's what would relate to people or that's what would get the people going. And, you know, it's amazing, even in the context of this show, how once we narrowed and really focused on the topics that we're passionate about, how much more relatable people have said we've become, and how much more people, seem to enjoy the show now. And even just being able to come to a site or come to a podcast and quickly know what it's about, as opposed to being confused, where it's like, okay, one day you guys are talking about Beyonce, next day you guys are talking about how to get your money right, after that you're talking about pro wrestling. What is this? You know. So it definitely resonates, and even thinking about that experience that you create for people when they first, because every day you're making a first impression on someone, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's a really big consideration when you're first getting out there, is, you know, you never know who's watching, you never know who's reading, listening. So always think about that experience that you want to create for people. And so, Marcus, I know you had something you wanted to throw in at this point.
Oh, I was going to, yeah, I pulled it from your website, but it's kind of part of our closeout. Normally, when I'm talking to somebody in the personal finance area, what I've been hitting them with lately is like their one best piece. I've kind of opened it up to quote, but the one that I got from your website was, and I really like this because I do, based on a number of personality traits that I can't figure out are good or bad, but I tend to be indifferent about them myself, is I do think that people can control their destiny. And the quote from your article was, instead of assuming you're a victim of circumstance, I assume that you are a master of your own fate. And so I want to share that with our listeners and then ask you, what is, if you had, and I tried to narrow it down to one for that specific purpose, one piece of advice that you could give people, what have you heard, or what would that be?
I think you hit the key message of Money Boss right there. But a lot of people think they're at the mercy of fate or chance or luck. And from my experience, the older I get, the more I believe that we have greater control over our future than we believe we do. And absolutely, there are certain things that are going to happen that we just have to deal with, right? I could go out, take the dog for a walk this morning, and get hit by a careless driver. And I don't have much control over that. But within the parameters of the things that do happen to us, it's up to us to decide how we are going to react to those things and what we're going to make out of them. I think the way that I commonly say it is, we don't get to choose what cards were dealt in life, but we get to choose how to play them. And sometimes you can take what looks like a losing hand and make it actually a winning hand, even against people who were dealt better cards. So it's up to us to figure out how to do that. And that's the fundamental message at Money Boss, is that I want people to make the decision, I am going to be in charge of my financial life, but not just my financial life, but all aspects of my life. I'm going to be inward focused. I'm going to be the one who says, all right, I'm going to figure out how to make the best investments. I'm going to be the one who goes out and finds the best mortgage. I'm going to be the one who goes out and shops for insurance. And I'm going to be the one who figures out what it is that makes me happy. And I'm going to be the one who loses weight and all that. I just want people to be more self-directed, because I think that people who do this tend to be happier and have more successful lives.
Dope.
Yeah, thank you. That was great. So where can we're nearing the wrap up here. So where can people find you, either website, social media, or do you have a catch all? Where can the folks find you at?
Well, moneyboss.com is where I'm writing about personal finance. Every once in a while, I go off on a rant at jdroth.com about random stuff. That tends to be my catch all, just like writing about life and philosophy. Yeah. And more and more, I'm active on Twitter at JD Roth.
Sounds good. Of course, you know, we'll get that all in the show notes for you folks.
Yeah. So JD, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been awesome chatting with you, and yeah, it got pretty damn insightful, if I say so myself.
Well, thanks, Rich and Marcus. It's actually one of the most fun times I've had on a podcast.
Oh, awesome.
It
yeah.
It was deep. Maybe it's because we are recording this on a Sunday, and maybe it's just the mood, you know, it's like deep and insightful and thoughtful.
Yeah, you know, woke up, burned some incense, you know, and meditate a little bit, and then come on a podcast. But it's definitely been an awesome time. I'm sure that our audience has gotten a lot from this. And so, of course, we want to thank everyone for listening. If you have topics you'd like to hear us cover or thoughts on this episode, you can email us at info@paychecksandbalances.com. And of course, don't forget to check out our Patreon page. So if you go to paychecksandbalances.com/patron or patron, if you're a drinker, we have a good campaign going there, trying to add some things to the show, trying to empower more people. And you now have a chance to be able to help us do that.
And don't forget to join our email list where we share top articles we read throughout the week, work and money tips, and more. Of course, this newsletter will probably plug several links to JD's website, so I'll have that for you. And you can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
There it is. So again, we want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks to JD for joining us. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.